From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Another black church has burned to the ground in Alabama. We'll take a look at the state attorney general, Jeff Sessions, who's supposedly investigating the terror. He's also running for the U.S. Senate.
We're getting ready to send a man to the Senate that leads the world in being backwards. But we like that. You know, we like that. We're normally lagging by 50 years behind here in Alabama. That's what we're doing. Yes, sir.
We'll talk to the leading Puerto Rican congressional candidates on federal tax breaks for business on the island. They raise questions about Puerto Rican sovereignty, citizenship, rights, and jobs. And a progressive political convention in California.
Of course people want to vote lesser evil. If somebody says to you, you got to work 5 days, you got to work 6 days, which do you choose? They say you're going to get 1 year or 2 years and you're innocent. Which one do you choose? Of course, lesser evil. But lesser evil's a trap, because when we go lesser evil, we always end up with the worst evil.
That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Senator Bob Dole lost a vote on national missile defense, but may have gained a campaign issue as he seeks to contrast his push for a missile shield with President Clinton's wait-and-see approach. Senate Democrats arguing that the Dole plan was too expensive mustered enough votes yesterday to block further debate and a Senate floor vote. In other arms news, the Clinton administration is close to completing an arms deal that would deliver F-16 combat jets to the military dictatorship of Indonesia. It is drawing fury from human rights advocates who oppose military sales to Indonesia because of that country's occupation and repression of East Timor. Indonesian military has killed more than a third of the population there. And in St. Louis, shortly after union leaders stormed out of talks, 6,700 McDonnell Douglas machinists went on strike today and immediately began picketing to protest the aerospace company's growing use of non-union workers. And taking a look at primaries yesterday in New Jersey, Congressmember Dick Zimmer barely had time to savor his easy victory in New Jersey's Republican Senate primary when fellow Congressmember Robert Torricelli started swinging. Unopposed in the Democratic primary for the seat of retiring Senator Bill Bradley, immediately took the offensive by linking Zimmer to the conservative agenda of House Speaker Newt Gingrich. He said, when it's defeated here, the tide will turn back all across this nation. Zimmer shot back, Bob Torricelli's liberal way is the old way. It has failed. Our way is the way to restore the American dream. The New Jersey contest, one of the most closely watched Senate races in the country, topped the busiest congressional primary day of the year so far. And incumbent senators in four other states, Iowa, New Mexico, South Dakota, and Montana, were unopposed for renomination. Bill Bradley and Hal Heflin of Alabama are two of 14 senators, eight Democrats, six Republicans, calling it quits this year, including Republican presidential challenger Bob Dole. Republicans see the fall election as a chance to solidify their 53-47 Senate majority, while Democrats view November as a shot to reversing those numbers. Today, we're going to take a look at the Alabama primary. Republican State Attorney General Jefferson Sessions wants to go to Washington to replace retiring Senator Hal Heflin. Although Sessions got the most votes, 38% yesterday, he didn't win a majority, so a runoff is scheduled for later this month. Jeff Sessions is the only nominee for a federal judgeship in recent years whose nomination was rejected. He's currently heading up two investigations in Alabama, an investigation of the bombing of black churches and an investigation into alleged voter fraud in the African-American community. Joining us now is Pacifica's Dennis Bernstein, who recently traveled to Alabama as part of his work on a documentary for Democracy Now! On the rash of church fires that's terrorizing the African-American community in the South. The latest one just took place 2 days ago in Alabama, in rural Hale County. A 65-year-old black church burned to the ground. Dennis, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Why don't we first talk about that church bombing, and then let's talk about Jeff Sessions and what his relation is to the investigation of this trend.
Well, Amy, that is the Rising Star Baptist Church. That is the sixth one to burn in Alabama since the beginning of the year. It is on the outskirts of Greensboro, Alabama, and in fact, it was a right in the heart of the cradle of the voting rights movement. Unlike the other ones, it was right on the outskirts of the city. The fire department got there rather quickly, 3 o'clock in the morning, and unlike the other six attacks, the ATF was actually there in a relatively short time. Between 8 and 10 of them were going through the ruins yesterday. Once again, though, they don't really have an idea of the exact motive, but the people in the area, the people in the congregation are convinced once again that this is the Klan white supremacy bubbling up in Alabama.
Now, let's talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who it's possible will win the Senate seat of Hal Heflin. Now, a decade ago, Heflin cast the deciding vote on the Senate Judiciary Committee against Sessions' nomination for a federal judgeship. He'd been accused of trying to intimidate black voters by unsuccessfully prosecuting three civil rights workers for vote fraud the year before. Who is this Jeff Sessions? We talked about him a couple weeks ago on Democracy Now! You had the head of a civil rights museum on who is extremely irate about Sessions, calling him, well, outright a racist.
Well, we're talking about Jefferson Beauregard Sessions. He is the former U.S. attorney from the Southern District. He is from Wilcox County. He is now the state attorney general. He's the chief law enforcement officer of the state, in charge with investigating, among other things, the church bombings. Now, this is somebody who was the 270th federal nominee for a federal judgeship that appeared before the Judiciary Committee. The other 269 were accepted. Mr. Sessions was rejected. He was rejected, according to that congressional testimony, because, among other things, he referred to the NAACP, the National Council of Churches, and the ACLU as un-American and pink commie. He also has said that he said at one point, "I used to think the Klan was all right until I found out some of them smoked pot." This is somebody who referred to his assistants as U.S. attorney and the Justice Department attorneys as boy. And the voter writing acts, he says, was something that was forced down the throats of people in Alabama. The most compelling problem that he had was this this investigation you mentioned as U.S. attorney, this voting rights investigation in which he went after Albert Turner and others. This was a 106-count indictment in which nobody ultimately went to jail, but in which Sessions dragged people all over the state, 188 miles to Mobile instead of Selma, where the proceedings were taking place. They had people in their 80s on this bus that was surrounded by police to appear before the grand jury. As a result of this intimidation, two of the older people, after this routine, died, one of a stroke and one of a heart attack. So this kind of policy has gotten Jeff Sessions in trouble. This has not stopped him from continuing the same policies as state attorney general. Under the guise of investigating of the churches, he has a voter fraud investigation. He issued a number of subpoenas, or he participated in an investigation that issued a number of subpoenas that were just issued a week before this primary. I've got one of these subpoenas in front of me, and if I had received it, I'd be terrified and afraid to vote.
Dennis, why don't we go to some of the tape of the interviews that you've been doing recently in Alabama? Dennis Bernstein, again, has been putting together a documentary for us on Democracy Now! And the church burnings. He is also, by the way, associate editor of Pacific News Service. Why don't you set this up for us?
Okay. What we're going to hear is an interview that I did with Ron Nixon of Southern Exposure magazine. He and I have been working on this investigation together. We have a bit of a piece on this coming up in the Nation magazine. This is Sheriff Prince Arnold, elected 5 times in Wilcox County. This is majority black county where Mr. Sessions comes from. By the way, the sheriff has written to Deval Patrick, the head of the civil rights investigating the churches, about these kinds of attacks by Jeff Sessions, these voter fraud attacks. The sheriff says he has provided a great deal of material that white voter fraud is existing, yet Sessions goes after black voter fraud. This is the sheriff talking about 4 years ago how he provided information to the FBI and then U.S. Attorney Jeffrey Sessions that there was a death plot against his life. A death plot, he says, was put together by voices he could recognize. He managed to obtain a tape of the plotters. He says, this sheriff says that Jeff Sessions knows who these people are, and they refuse to act on this possible assassination plot. So this is the sheriff talking about that.
When you destroy the churches, you're destroying the politics in the black community. You're destroying the soul of the black community. You're doing so much to them when you destroy their churches. That's the only building where all of them have gathered together to build, you know. And people know that. There are folks who know our history better than we do, much better than we do, you know, because a lot of us, when we leave here, we forget about our history. But it's a form of intimidation. Whoever's doing this, whoever is burning and bombing the black churches needs to be called and prosecuted because it's affecting the whole race of people. That's what it's doing. My name is Prince Arnold, and that's A-R-N-O-L-D. I'm the sheriff of Wilcox County. I'm serving my fifth term as sheriff, going on 18 years. My family, my father and my grandfather was born and raised here in Wilcox County. I received my elementary and high school education here. I graduated from Alabama State University. And I'm just back home. I came back home and ran as sheriff, and I've won five consecutive times. I consider myself a community worker, not just a sheriff. Our communities need so much help, and I just go out and do all I can to help in the community. Selective prosecution was one of the main reasons why I ran for sheriff in 1978. There has always been a double standard here in Wilcox County and in the South, and probably all across this country. People have prioritized what they want to, who they want to prosecute. And when it comes to voter fraud or anything else, it's the same thing. People have always been, if certain folks got killed or murdered, there was a very little investigation done. As far as prosecution, it was done on a very lukewarm manner. When it comes to all law enforcement, it's always been a double standard. So we tried to just have one standard. That's what we tried to do over the last 18 years. Every time we have people like Mr. Session and other folks who come in basically because of that same group who had that double standard years ago. And they were, Mr. Session was summoned here by that group saying that we need to just go back to the old practice, as they would say. And that's what he did. He came in and selected a couple of people and said, I'm going to put y'all in jail and show you all how it's supposed to be done. But we're here, I'm the sheriff, and I'm not going to let it be done. Mr. Jeff Session, like I did, went to school here. You know, he went to high school here, and he continues to come back here. This is his home, and his family's from here. I'm sure he, like I do, I own a couple of acres here. I'm sure he owns property here, too. People who he finished high school with are the ones who summoned him back here. People who we see on a daily basis that hold positions in, I'm sure, in banks and stores are Jeff Sessions' classmates. See? And they have continued to communicate with him over the last, like I said, 18 years since he was down there in the Southern District of Alabama. And they have tried down through the years to get him to come back and do these type of things. It's very simple. It's It's not complicated. That man has personal interest down here to get it back the way it was before I got ran to be before I got to be sheriff.
And you say he has friends and back to the way it was. The way it was as in pre-civil rights, as in when Klan types and white supremacists were around. Is that what we're talking about?
You know your history well. Yeah, you know your history well. No doubt about it. Wilcox counted the 1990 census. I think we have 69 point something black, about 70% black. They said black folks run during the census time, so it might be more than that. But until I ran as sheriff, until I ran for the position, blacks didn't hold a single elected position, not a single one. And people bragged about being able to rule a county. It was something like South Africa. You know, and that's, certain people are not going to be satisfied until it gets back to that to that position, back in that condition. So, yes, sir, we're talking about pre-civil rights days. We're talking about where people are afraid to go and vote. We're talking about where people are intimidated to the point where they're just afraid to do anything besides the domestic work. Alabama has always led the country when it came to being backwards. And every civil rights thing, and we're getting ready to send a man to Senate that leads the world in being backwards. But we like that. You know, we like that. We're normally lagging by 50 years behind here in Alabama. That's what we're doing. Yes, sir.
In regards to intimidation, I understand that you revealed, by virtue of receiving information in the form of a tape and other related documentary evidence, that there was a plot to kill you. Could you describe, give us some information about that?
I received a tape from another law enforcement agency. It's a sheriff's office. They called me and said, "Sheriff, we receive information that there's a death threat on your life." And I've been threatened many times over the last 18 years. But this particular time, I called in the FBI, called them in, gave them the tape. It's sitting right where you're sitting now, two agents. And I told them what had happened. It was during the time that Mr. Session was the he was the prosecutor down Southern District of Alabama down in Mobile. And I haven't heard anything from them, those agents as of today. Now,
that's 2 years.
Oh, it's been long that. Been longer than that. He was down there. It was before President Clinton was elected. So he didn't leave from down there. It was before President Clinton was elected. But I haven't heard anything from these people. And I know during the time he was down there, when agents moved, they moved at when he said go and investigate whatever. If you understand what I'm saying. Because I've talked to too many of the young people he went to school with then, and when I say young, my age. And I couldn't get in touch with Mr. Session to get him up here, but they could. You don't hear what I'm saying.
Describe what was on the tape, please.
Oh, basically, in detail, it talked about, and I know the people who was plotting them. I know the people. Mr. Session knows them, too. He went to school with them. He knows them, too, if he heard the tape, if he had any conversation with the agents. I'm not saying he did. I'm just saying that the information was turned over to them while he was down there. That's what I'm saying. They described in detail where I lived, what type of weapon would be used to kill me, where the shooter would be standing, and the type of money it would cost to get it done.
And you provided that tape to the FBI, who investigate for Mr. Sessions as U.S. attorney at the time.
Well, Wilcox County is in the southern district of the state of Alabama. I'm sure any major crime that being investigated at some point in time, they give that information to the prosecutor.
And that is Sheriff Prince Arnold speaking with Dennis Bernstein. Dennis, last comment.
I'll tell you, people are going to be running for cover, according to Prince Arnold, if Jeffrey Sessions becomes the next senator of Alabama. People are terrified. And they are very concerned that the church investigation will turn into one more black voter fraud investigation. We should watch this race very closely.
And Dennis Bernstein, we will. Dennis Bernstein, associate editor of Pacific News Service and co-author of forthcoming piece in The Nation. He is doing a documentary on the church burnings for Democracy Now! Thanks for joining us. Up next, Puerto Rican tax breaks. Are they corporate welfare for U.S. businesses? Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. One of the most heated issues in the relationship between Puerto Rico and the U.S. federal government is Section 936 of the IRS tax code, which gives generous tax benefits to U.S. companies that set up in Puerto Rico. But some in Washington say it's corporate welfare. The House just passed a law repealing Section 936, and the Senate will consider the issue in the next 2 weeks. Juan Gonzalez, my co-host in New York, has been following this issue closely. Juan writes for the Daily News. Juan, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good morning. The situation right now is that the House has repealed it, but in the next week or two, there's a very good chance, it seems, that the Senate may also repeal 936 as part of the minimum wage bill, as Republicans have tacked it on in an attempt to basically provide financing for incentives to small businesses that would also accompany the minimum wage bill, that is the rise in the minimum wage that is expected to pass. And so what we have with us today, first, Celeste Benitez, one of the leaders of the Popular Party in Puerto Rico, also the president of the Democratic Party in Puerto Rico, from San Juan, who will talk to us a little bit about why she believes that, 936 is responsible for about 100,000 jobs, in industrial jobs in Puerto Rico, but it also results in about $3.3 billion a year in tax savings to U.S. corporations. So this is why, given the budget squeezes of the past several years in Congress, there's been a lot of movement to attempt to repeal it. Celeste, are you with me here?
Yes, Juan. Good morning. And
good morning to you.
Let me also say good morning to all of the people who are hearing this program throughout the United States. Thank you for the privilege of allowing me to share with our friends on the mainland information on an issue where Puerto Rico's economic lifeline is at stake.
Could you tell us a little bit about the main arguments, why you think the retention of 936 is so critical?
Well, to begin with, one, some people in the United States and in the Congress and in the U.S. Treasury Department see 936 mainly as a tax break, as corporate welfare for corporations in the United States. But they do not see 936 as what it really is, an instrument to create jobs and to stimulate economic development in Puerto Rico. You just have to look at the history of 936 over the past 20 years. It was created in 1976, and 936 provides U.S. companies doing business in Puerto Rico three kinds of benefits. First, a tax credit based on the income they generate from their operations on the island. Second, and in the alternative, a tax credit based on 60% of the wages paid to employees on the island. And third, it provides exemption on the investment income earned from funds deposited, 936 funds, we call them, deposited in island banks, which are utilized for certain eligible activities, such as home mortgages, student loans, and commercial loans for equipment to be utilized in public transportation, business, among others. 936 exists to create jobs and to stimulate economic development in Puerto Rico. It has been very, very effective in doing that. Our economy, as you know, has over the last 40 years developed a modern industrial sector characterized by technological sophistication, high wages, and stability. Since the adoption of Section 936 in 1976, 20 years ago, Puerto Rico's economy has been transformed from a labor-intensive, low-wage economy to a high-wage, high-value-added industrial producer. Section 936 has been instrumental in creating these conditions and in making Puerto Rico a world-class center of pharmaceutical, electronics, and other high-technology sectors. Well over 100,000 direct jobs have been created by firms working in Puerto Rico under Section 936. Indirectly, many hundreds of thousands of jobs have been created both on the island and on the mainland, as it has been widely recognized.
What kind of industry are we talking about?
Pardon?
What kind of industry are we talking about?
We're talking about a very wide range of industries, pharmaceuticals, electronics, other high-technology sectors, but also textiles and labor-intensive industries. All of them benefit from the benefits of Section 936.
Now, Celeste, you say that 936 has been around since 1976, but before that there were other versions of the same kind of tax exemption, right? Wasn't it 931 or overseas possession tax credit?
It really goes back to 1921. So it's been in the books in the U.S. Tax code since 1921 for the past 75 years, and it was originally created back in 1921 to provide U.S. companies the possibility of competing effectively with British companies, which were then established in Hong Kong. In 1921, U.S. possessions included not only Puerto Rico, but also the Philippine Islands in the east. And 1921, which was the original section in the code, was designed to provide American industries some tax incentives in order to compete effectively with Hong Kong as a center for attracting industry.
No one denies the effectiveness of creating some industrial jobs. From the side over here in the United States, there is a viewpoint that, for instance, some companies like Johnson & Johnson realize as much as $100 million a year in tax savings. That, in effect, it comes out about 90% of their total wage costs, according to some estimates, are taken care of by these tax credits. It's an incredibly lucrative situation, especially for those companies that are very knowledge intensive or research intensive, to be able to reap these benefits. What do you say to Americans squeezed by budget problems here, and these congressmen who are obviously reacting to these pressures to continue this $3.3 billion tax benefit for a few corporations in the United States, not all of them?
Well, Juan, I must admit, and everybody does, that some companies have abused that privilege. But, you know, eliminating 936 to punish those companies which may have abused that privilege in the past is like throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It's like eliminating a section which is very important for Puerto Rico's economy just because some companies have abused those privileges in the past. We have constantly said, let's deal with those abuses. Let's make sure that this does not happen again, but do not do away with an incentive that is vital for Puerto Rico to remain competitive as an economy here in this region. You must understand that Puerto Rico is still, even though we have made very great strides in this century, but we are still a very poor economy with a per capita income less than a third of the U.S. as a whole and roughly half that of the state of Mississippi, which is the state with the lowest per capita income in the United States. And you must remember that many factors account for this situation. We have in Puerto Rico an extremely high population density of well over 1,000 persons per square mile. We lack an adequate resource base. We depend on petroleum for 99% of our energy needs, and we face very high shipping and transportation costs. Because, as
let me ask you, though, about the opposition, obviously, is the statehood party of Governor Roselló and also of Carlos Romero Barceló, the resident commissioner, who insists that the tax benefit should be replaced by, in essence, a wage credit that would be geared to the creation of jobs rather than to absolving companies from having to pay taxes on their profits. And this has become, obviously, the 936 has been the hallmark of the Popular Democratic Party's periods of success in the island. What do you say to the statehooders who support repealing 936 in favor of a wage credit?
Well, statehooders support the repeal of Section 936, and it is their support for this that has been instrumental in bringing the situation to what it now is. Statehooders do not support 936 because it is incompatible with statehood for Puerto Rico, because the uniformity clause of the U.S. Constitution prohibits the federal government from granting states taxation privileges on a selective basis. Section 936 should have to go if Puerto Rico were ever to become a state of the Union. That is the reason why the pro-statehood Governor Romero Roselló and pro-statehood Resident Commissioner Romero Barceló have been going at 936 for the past 4 years, because they see 936 as an obstacle in Puerto Rico's path towards statehood. And because they want to take advantage of this particular political situation in the United States at present, where they can say it was not us statehooders who did away with 936. It was the U.S. Congress and the President of the United States.
All right, Celeste, well, thank you very much for joining us from San Juan, and we're going to move now to the resident commissioner, Carlos Romero Barceló, who's in Washington. We have just a resident commissioner. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome this morning.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
We've just heard from Celeste Benitez, who has told us basically why her party feels that that 936 should remain. You have been in the forefront of attempts to repeal it in favor of a wage credit.
That's correct.
But now you're faced with the reality that apparently the Republicans in Washington, in Congress, have repealed it without your wage credit, and it's very likely that in the Senate in the next week or two, the same thing may happen. Could you tell us a little bit why you are so insistent that this has to be repealed, and then what you would do if there is no wage credit attached to it? What's going to be the result in Puerto Rico?
In the first place, I think it's important that we talk about tax credits based on wages or tax credit based on income, and not just on numbers. I mean, if you will notice, Celeste Benitez and others to defend the outrageous tax credit based on income always say Section 936, and they created like an aura on Section 936. We should forget about the numbers of sections and think in terms of tax credit based on income. Tax credit based on income were never meant to be for the create jobs. As a matter of fact, she herself told you the story of these tax credits, which started way back in 1920s. When the United States wanted to compete with English trading companies and Dutch trading companies in the East, and it was really for Philippines, and it was to give advantage to the companies, make them earn more money and make their competition advantageous for them, were never to create jobs, because tax credits on income do not stimulate creation of jobs. Tax credit based on wages does stimulate creation of jobs, and at the same time it allows collection of revenues by the U.S. Treasury. One of the problems that we have had, we need jobs, and we are convinced that tax credit based on wages will be much more effective creating jobs in Puerto Rico, and also creating opportunities for research and development. Because now, with tax credit based on income, there is no incentive for research and development, which is a mere cost. It's a costly enterprise. Whereas when you have that tax credit based on wages, there will be an incentive for research and development. And at the same time, say, well, the revenues that are collected from Puerto Rico can be used to help Puerto Rico in those programs where we're being shortchanged, like, for instance, health care. You know, Medicaid, we get less than 10% of what we would get if we were a state. If any state of the union had to pay for over 90% of its health care costs, they'd be broke. And here it is, the poorest jurisdiction in the United States, the lowest per capita income, the highest unemployment, the highest poverty rate, and we get less than 10% for Medicaid. And the reason, we don't pay federal taxes. Well, now they're being collected in Puerto Rico. Let us use that money. And that's what the president is recommending. And that's why it would be so much better for Puerto Rico if we were in the first place not having these outrageous tax benefits for the companies that don't do much good for Puerto Rico, but they do a lot of good for the companies. And at the same time, create a dependency in Puerto Rico on these outrageous tax credits. And it's like you hear some of these people say that we can't have anything in Puerto Rico unless we have 936.
Yes, but Resident Commissioner, let me ask you again. The problem apparently is that you're getting the repeal. You will soon get the repeal because the Republicans have attached the bill to the minimum wage bill. But you are not getting apparently the wage credits. What will happen in Puerto Rico economically if on one hand you repeal 936, but you don't substitute any other kind of incentives?
Well, we will find out if that happens. But I'm sure that there are incentives in Puerto Rico. We could do a lot better if we have the tax credit based on wages. I have no doubt about it. But I think without it, we still have enough incentives. Your people are shortchanging the productivity of the Puerto Rican workers, which are more productive than the workers in the mainland, according to the studies made by the U.S. Manufacturers Association. They're more loyal to the companies. They stay longer working. They're less absenteeism. They still the wage rate at home is still 2/3 to 3/4 of what it is up here. So there's substantial incentives to go to Puerto Rico and invest in Puerto Rico.
What have been the roles of senators, New York senators D'Amato and Moynihan? Moynihan played a very important role last time in preserving 936 in 1993 when it was about to be abolished. What's been their position? They seem to have been kind of quiet this time around in the debate.
Yeah, well, in the first place, they don't have the power that they had before when the Democrats were a majority. Now the Republicans are a majority, so obviously the authority is much more in the hands of the Republicans than in the hands of the Democrats. So they have to try to look for some kind of a arrangement with the Republicans. I'm sure that there's no doubt
about. What about Senator D'Amato?
D'Amato has been out of this issue a little bit. Has not been involved in this issue much. You have much more. Have been Senator Roth and Senator Chafee have been much more involved in this issue. And of course, the Senator Dole, before he decided he was going to resign, he had been directing this issue from his position. But I think that the problem now is we have to try to convince everyone. I think everyone is aware that the best thing for Puerto Rico and for the nation would be to tax credit based on wages. House, when we had the debate on the bill, Kasich acknowledged that the tax credit based on wages was something was good, and he said that we would be addressing that issue, and he wanted to talk further.
Resident Commissioner, I'd like to ask you in the couple of minutes that we have left, the governor, Governor Rosselló, a few days ago, and you're both of the same party, made an unusual statement that he would not see himself supporting either of the two Puerto Rican Congress members, one from Chicago, Luis Gutierrez, or Nidia Velasquez from New York. And some people feel it's in part because of their involvement in protecting 936 or attempting to. What do you feel about the governor's statement? I know you and he have often agreed and often disagreed, even though you're from the same party. What do you feel about the role of the three Puerto Ricans in Congress in the debate over what should happen to 936 in Puerto Rico?
I think that the you cannot join them all three together because Serrano has been very responsible in his statements. We might not agree, as you know, people cannot always agree in everything. We might not agree on issues, but whenever he takes a different side, he's very responsible. But Nidia Velázquez and Gutierrez, they're beholden to these companies who have brought them, you know, through their industrial associate, the Manufacturers Association, the Bankers Association, the PRUSA here in the U.S. They represent these the companies, the 936 companies, have brought them down to Puerto Rico, and they have fundraisers for them. They help them raise funds for them. So they're beholden to the companies. They argue for the companies without any facts. They say, we're going to lose 300,000 jobs, and then they don't give you any facts. Either the companies themselves and the opponents.
Okay.
They talk about losing jobs, but they don't give you the facts. They don't give you why. Every time we analyze a company, we say, hey, wait a minute.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your time, Resident
Commissioner. You're very welcome.
And Juan, thank you very much for your time. Carlos Romero Barceló, who is currently the Resident Commissioner, Congress member from Puerto Rico, and he is being opposed by Celeste Benitez. We should add the 104th Congress, the Republican majority, remove their ability to vote. You're listening to Democracy Now! Juan Gonzalez with us from New York. And we're going on now to talk about politics in California. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. A Mississippi school district is likely to appeal a court decision banning school prayer. On Monday, a federal judge ruled that the Pontotoc County School System's 50-year tradition of Bible study classes and prayers over the intercom is unconstitutional. The ruling stems from a 1994 lawsuit filed by the ACLU and Lisa Herdahl, a Lutheran mother whose children were being harassed and threatened for challenging school prayer in the largely Southern Baptist community. Lisa Herdahl spoke with reporters when she heard the decision.
Children have the right to pray in school. They've always had the right to pray in school. They can't use the school facilities. They don't need to be using the intercom. They don't need the teachers to help them. They don't need the school to help them. But any student at any time can pray during the day. They can bow their head silently and pray before lunch. They can bow their head and pray silently during break, any time during the day they want. Children are still allowed to pray in school, just without the school's help.
The subject of school prayer is likely to rear its head again in this election year. Both President Clinton and Bob Dole support some kind of voluntary school prayer or a moment of silent reflection.
Okay, I'm here at the monthly meeting of the Willimunking School Board, and joining me is school board member Roy Osgood.
Hello.
Mr. Osgood, your school district is one of the first in the country to mandate school prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us how that came about?
Certainly. Last month, we put forward a motion designed to make some form of voluntary school prayer mandatory throughout the district.
Mm-hmm.
The content of the prayer was to be determined by the religious beliefs of the majority of the community. Since the majority of this community are Hellenists, mm-hmm. it was decided that the prayer should reflect the worship of the gods of ancient Greece.
Of ancient Greece?
That's right, yes. Anyway, mandatory voluntary school prayer was adopted.
Has it been much of an adjustment for the students?
No, not at all. Their day is the same as it always was. except that each morning a bull is slaughtered, its liver is examined, and then the thigh bone is burnt upon the sacrificial fire.
I see. That sounds like it would take some getting used to.
Well, if the senators and congressmen in Washington can begin each day with prayer, there's no reason why decent, God-fearing children in this district can't begin each day with a mandatory voluntary animal sacrifice.
And what about children who have different religious beliefs? How have they been affected?
Look, no one is forcing anyone to do anything. But it seems to me that a dose of good old-fashioned values is not going to hurt any of these children of unbelievers. It's not going to hurt any of them to know how to sacrifice a bull or goat and remove the liver. And if it does, if they are that offended, why, then they can merely pretend to read the entrails when their turn comes to be honorary high priest. But it's about time we concern ourselves here with the rights of the God-fearing majority. Now, if you'll excuse me, I have to present my motion to the board.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Osgood.
Hail Zeus.
Just a reminder, you are listening to our live coverage of the monthly meeting of the Willamunking School Board, where board member Roy Osgood is about to address the board. Let's listen in.
I would remind the board that our work is just beginning. Have any of you read a standard school textbook recently?
No.
I will give you just one example of the many I find objectionable. In a fourth grade science book, the children, our children, are taught that the Earth revolves around the sun in an orbit which causes seasonal change.
Yeah.
I know. Now, I am not saying that this theory should be stricken from our children's textbooks. But let's at least include the sacred story of Persephone, who, as we know, ate 7 pomegranate seeds while a prisoner of Hades, a brother of Zeus and lord of Tartarus, whereupon Zeus decreed that she spend 6 months of every year as queen of the underworld and 6 months on earth with her mother Demeter, the harvest goddess, who celebrates her daughter's annual return by granting spring and summer.
Hail Demeter.
And again, I am not saying we should favor one explanation over the other, merely that we present them as equally fact-based and equally plausible. And I'd like that put to a vote.
Members in favor of Board Member Osgood's motion? The motion is passed unanimously. The sacred story of Persephone is hereby ordered included in all science textbooks.
Thank you.
You've been listening to our live coverage of the monthly meeting of the Willamunking School Board, and now back to the studio.
Satire from the Sturdy Beggars comedy duo of Pennsylvania, here on Democracy Now! This past weekend, 300 people gathered in Oakland, California for the founding convention of the Alameda County Progressive Alliance, where grassroots activists strategize for this election year and beyond. Pacifica National Affairs correspondent Larry Bensky was there and has this report.
Clinton's a Democrat, you know what that means. Got lots of friends behind the scenes. He's a disappointment as the man from hope. His campaign promises went up in smoke. Should I go to bat for him? Because these evils, he's the lesser of, oh yes.
Some form of progressive political action is not unusual in Alameda County, in Berkeley, at the University of California, and in Oakland, where the Black Panthers began. Historians now credit the 1964 free speech movement in Berkeley, the late 60s anti-war uprisings at the university, and the actions of the Black Panthers in organizing the African American community a few years later as the beginning of the movement, which eventually led to the election of supposedly progressive majorities on the Oakland and Berkeley city councils, and for the now 26-year-long career of Ron Dellums as the congressional representative whose district takes in most of Alameda County. But progressives these days say that those electoral successes haven't been enough, and that new energy is necessary to keep elected officials working for peace and social justice goals, as well as replacing those officials who don't work hard enough towards those goals. The 300 people attending the founding convention of the Alameda Progressive Alliance heard speeches outlining the task ahead of them, participated in workshops around key social and environmental issues, and for the fewer than 50 people who remained by Sunday afternoon,
There were resolutions to be passed dealing with a wide diversity of issues. That more people did not attend and that the energies of those who did attend tended to be dispersed in various activities was of concern to opening day speaker Buna Chima, who is executive director of Berkeley Oakland Support Services, a homeless and poor people's emergency organization.
And it's no accident that when I look across this room that it's not full. Where are the people? Where is the language that we're going to need to learn to bring people back into the political structure of things, to create a political voice? We have to go out, folks, and find those people. They're there. But nobody is out there doing popular education, door knocking, walking the streets, visiting the hospitals, being in the social services department, being in touch with the people who are suffering, talking with each other. No, we are here today at 5 o'clock. Most of us will go home. Tomorrow we will come back, work really hard, and then we will go home. But I urge you not to do that anymore. To stay in the community, to get on those phones, to start talking to people, to start making people understand, to learn from Clinton what rapid response really means. There's one thing we can learn from his campaign is rapid response. We don't have that.
One of the best received proposals at the Alameda County Convention came from veteran political activist Peter Camejo. Once president of the UC student body, Camejo subsequently ran unsuccessfully for a variety of offices, including in 1976 as the Socialist Workers Party candidate for president. In one of the more unusual trajectories for 60s activists, Camejo is now chief executive officer for the $700 million socially responsible investment company Progressive Assets Management. Camejo says that progressive political candidates should demand a change in the electoral system itself so that the true strength of the left in the United States can be expressed.
Well, we have to fight for democracy in America. Look, if 30% of the people vote for position, they should have 30% of the seats. You do not have to be a rocket scientist to figure that out. Yet we say, okay, they know this in Latin America, they know this in Africa, in Asia, in Europe, everywhere else they know this. Oh, but the American people can't figure this out. The average person understand this is for it. There's somebody who's against it. There's someone who's preventing it. Look, Ralph Nader wants to run for president. But if Ralph Nader runs for president, it helps Dole get elected. That is the exact opposite of what Ralph Nader is trying to achieve. So what should we do? Tell Ralph Nader, don't run. Keep your mouth shut. We should then all shut up. Or should Ralph Nader run and help Dole? Isn't that interesting how they have us all tied up? All you got to do is have all you have to have is preferential voting. Let people vote their first choice or second choice. Of course people want to vote lesser evil. If somebody says to you, you got to work 5 days, you got to work 6 days, which do you choose? They say you're going to get 1 year or 2 years and you're innocent. Which one do you choose? Of course, lesser evil. But lesser evil is a trap because when we go lesser evil, we always end up with the worst evil. That is the logic. In today's world, the Republicans tell us what the corporations and the rich want, and the Democrats try to figure out how to implement it. The Democrats are the lubricant and the ones who argue with the Republicans that all their demands are not practical. We have no voice. Now, if we had preferential voting, it would, and vote Ralph Nader's running would be a real blow to Dole. We must change the electoral laws of the United States if we are to be a democracy.
Many of the speakers at the Alameda County Convention insisted on a results-oriented approach to politics. Mark Friedman recently finished third in a 5-person contest for the Democratic Party nomination for California State Assembly.
Those of us who are veterans of foreign and domestic political wars have heard and spoken it all before, and we gain little by repeating the same rhetoric. For every hour we spend in a meeting like this, we should all make a commitment. We're going to spend 5 or 10 hours working on a campaign, walking precincts or making phone calls, getting involved in... Everybody who claps has to do 5 hours for every hour. For progressive politics to succeed, we need to deliver. That means we have to be about providing access to health care, to building homes for people, to revitalizing neighborhoods, creating sustainable jobs. We will only succeed if we can create some results that people see, hey, these progressives do more than talk about it. They're actually doing stuff for people in the community.
In age, race, and geographical distribution, delegates at the Progressive Alliance Convention were obviously not representative of Alameda County as a whole, a fact which was observed by more than one speaker, including Marsha Fineland, who's state chair of the Peace and Freedom Party in California and is an elected member of the City of Berkeley's Rent Control Board.
I see a lot of people here who look a lot like me, around the same age, people who are white people. And I don't think that this is a bad thing, but I think we definitely need to be able to attract more people to our movement, and I definitely think we need to attract young people to our movement. Part of the reason that many of us are here is because we're from a generation that was active in the 60s. We were active in the civil rights movement. We were active in the anti-war movement. We kind of came of age during a culture of struggle and rebellion. People were talking about Marxism. People were talking about socialism. We learned these things, and we felt somehow that we were connected to struggles of the past. Now it feels like the left is in a closet. We're really isolated, and I think a big reason for that is that the left has, a very big part of the left has disappeared into the Democratic Party.
An ongoing committee of 25 people was elected as the Alameda Convention ended. One of their first tasks will be to see which, if any, local races in November the group will get involved in and to organize their efforts so that any involvement will make a difference. There was some disappointment that a solid third-party effort did not emerge as a priority from the two-day convention, but there was also a widespread recognition that building the coalition as a meaningful electoral force will be a long task and will involve separating candidates and voters from the entrenched Democratic Party machinery which dominates Alameda County. James Vann is a longtime political organizer who attended the Atlanta Independent Politics Summit meeting back in April and returned home to help organize this weekend's event. I spoke to him as the convention ended.
I would like to have seen a clearer commitment to building a real alternative to the Democrats and the Republicans. The passion that I see evidenced in the room among those who are participating in the convention is more toward there's a real hurt that's going on inside of people to cut their ties to the Democratic Party or even to be able to look down the road. Nothing that was put forward in the form of proposals stated that we are immediately forming a third party or moving away, but that as a long-term goal, we're looking toward the establishment of an independent party and bringing people into a new movement to form an alternative to the Democrats and the Republicans. I don't see that there is even in a long term, as a long-term goal, that there's a commitment to that kind of vision. Where I think the disconnect comes is that we do have progressive legislators, progressive representatives. What we don't have is their ability to be effective. While their intentions are to be progressive or to offer programs or to speak the kind of speech that concurs with our liberal and more progressive philosophy, they can't accomplish that within the Democratic Party. So I like to look at the Progressive Alliance of Alameda County as a place where people can begin to look toward. I see these people, I see the voters, I see the politicians as being people who are in the process of moving away from the Democratic Party.
One of the pillars of the Democratic Party nationally, and certainly here in Alameda County, is the African American community. And we've had African American people elected on all levels, from city councils to mayors to county supervisors for years now, to Congress for that matter.
When you, as you do, and as you have done for many years now, go around the African-American community and talk politics, what do you say to people to try to get them interested in something other than the Democratic Party, which, after all, has been a vehicle for African-American advancement politically?
That's certainly true. However, I think more and more people in the African-American and other people of color communities are really voting with their feet. And the turnout in elections for Democrats and so forth is way down. In West Oakland, just in the past city council elections, which had some partisan races in the primary, the turnout in some of those precincts was as low as 11%. So people are voting with their feet. It's going to be hard for the African-American community to break its ties with the Democratic Party because they know what the program is of the Republican Party. They are afraid of what the program is of the Democratic Party. They really don't analyze it in detail. But they know that it's not serving them. And so that's hard. But I think what's happening, I think they're looking. I think if what we do in the Progressive Alliance, if we're serious about really going out to people and doing action programs on issues that affect people, I think they will look closely at us. And I think as we accomplish things, as we have results, we'll be able to bring more people into it. Because I think there's a real feeling that people would like to see something different.
Veteran political organizer James Vann speaking at the conclusion of this weekend's founding convention of the Alameda County Progressive Alliance in Oakland. I'm Larry Bensky for Pacifica Radio.
And I'm Amy Goodman.